Well, good morning. I feel like we're missing a few people, are we? There's not too many cars, or there are too many cars.
Maybe it's just the morning and my brain tricked me. I feel like there's a lot of cars.
Okay. It's good to be with you again. This will be my last time for a while, but we didn't quite get done with some of the stuff we were looking at last time, and so I want to finish that up today, and I want to go back and revisit Genesis 1, 1, and 2 with you from my perspective and everything, and Mike's good with that, so let's pray. Could a couple of you lead us in prayer, and then we'll get going?
Heavenly Father, we just thank you so much for what you have planned for us today, and we just ask that you would speak through Rick and use Rick as your instrument to communicate to us as you open up our hearts and you open up our minds to understanding how much you love us and how you want us to share that with the world.
I want to thank you again for the opportunity to come here each and every morning and sit down with a solid group of people and learn more about who you are and how you see us, Father. I pray that you would make our hearts sensitive to what you would have for us today. And I pray that we would just grow and that you would mold us and shape us in who we are because of what you've done. In your name, I pray. Amen.
Amen. Thanks. Well, I don't know if you have the handout I gave you last week, but if you do, you might want to pull that out. If you don't, you can just take notes apart from that. Yes. So if you have your notes and you want to follow along on those, we're going to begin on page 6. Page 6. And, yes. Uh-huh. The one that has the this map on the front of it, if you have that still. Yes. And, so we covered some of this. Some of it was pretty quick, trying to get through it and everything. What I'd like us to look at for a few minutes are, again, some of the things that Abraham would have studied when he was in school in Ur of the Chaldees. So what were some of the subjects he would have studied and all of that? So the first one that's mentioned there on page 6 is botany. He would have studied that. How to grow and take care of all kinds of botanical things, trees, crops, all that kind of stuff. He would have studied that. And he studied how to grow those things in a desert. Okay? The main source of income for the region, for Ur of the Chaldees, this kingdom that had grown up in that area, was food. And we'll look at that a little bit more later on. But they grew crops there in that desert. They planted shade trees in the middle of a desert where there was no water and that sort of thing. I think I mentioned to you Genesis 21. In Genesis 21, we see Abraham in Beersheba, which is in the desert, in the middle of nowhere, this rocky, hot desert. We see Abraham planting a tamarisk tree. And when you go there today, you can still see tamarisk trees all over that southern desert area. And again, why did Abraham settle in that area? Of all the lush places he could have settled for most of his life, and bore and raised his children there. He went to the desert because that was home. That was familiar to him. That's what he was used to. He knew how to live there in that desert. And part of it was because of his botanical training. He knew how to raise crops there. He knew how to plant shade trees there. He knew how to take care of himself there. The second area is zoology. Again, how to raise herds, how to take care of them, animal husbandry, it would be called, but sheep and cattle, how to take care of them. And he was very good at that, and his sons were very good at that as well. And grandsons, you think about Jacob, made his fortune in animal husbandry, in how to take care of and raise sheep. He was a master at it, and his father-in-law Laban was amazed at how well he did that. Well, where did he learn those kind of things? It goes all the way back to Abraham, and learning a lot of that going all the way back to Sumer, in that area where he grew up, and the education that he got. Mineralogy, we talked about that. We talked about geography. Again, knowing the area of the Fertile Crescent, knowing how that Fertile Crescent worked. When he left, when God told him to leave Ur of the Chaldees and go to a land that I will show you, why did Abraham, what led him to go north along the Tigris-Euphrates River? He was just following the Fertile Crescent. He was following where he knew there would be water for his herds that he had with him and the cattle that he had with him. He knew there would be water for them. He knew there would be grass along the rivers for them to eat. He knew that there would be more cities along the rivers than there would be in the desert. He knew the geography, and a lot of that goes back to his education. Pottery, again, there. When we look at pottery, we often think of pottery today in our culture as decorative kind of things. We think of it that way. But in their day, how can you build a pot that you can put in cold water, stick on a hot fire, and it's going to be okay? And it's not going to crack. It's not going to break up and everything because of the extremes of hot and cold and all those kind of things. Well, they built a lot of that. They learned how to do that there in school. Theology, they studied that. And as we talked about before, a lot of what he would have studied would have been in theology, would have been polytheism. Would have studied that because that was what was prevalent in the day that he was raised and everything. But they also studied other things in theology, and there were a lot of things we're going to look at in a few minutes that were carryovers all the way back to what you've studied in Genesis so far. Going all the way back to Genesis chapter 1, part of that was part of their culture and part of their theology. And became part of their laws as well. Astronomy, we talked about that as well. The wise men from the east would have come from this area, following the star. And all of that goes back to this area.
When they studied like the Genesis era and things, it was in a different book, right? It wasn't in the books that we have, like Genesis and stuff. It was
correct.
It
would have been primarily most of those kind of things. So the question is, it wouldn't have been in the book of Genesis that they studied that. Moses wrote that in around 1450. We're looking at right now, Abraham was born in 2166 BC. So many years ahead of time before that. Most of their history, not all of it by any stretch, because I told you they have history books and documents that they had written and everything, kept lists of kings and their kingdoms, and they kept a written record of the histories, but they didn't have a lot of copies of that. So for the average person, most of the stuff they learned would have been through oral, it's called oral tradition, the passing on of things orally. And they were very good at that, passing things on and telling stories and passing those on to their children, their grandchildren, and that sort of thing, and reiterating that. When we have so many things to occupy our time today. So when the sun goes down and we've finished our school day, work day, whatever, we're at home, there are so many things we can do. You just turn on the lights, you can turn on a TV, you can pick up a book and read a book. You can do a lot of different things. What if you don't have lights? What if the best you've got is a candle? That's all you have in the evening. You don't have TV. You don't have movies to go to. You can't go out and eat and all that. You're at home night after night after night after night. What do you do? You talk, you tell stories. Telling stories was there a way of entertainment and also a way of passing on the histories and the traditions, etc. They were very good at rote memory because that was what was emphasized from the time they were born, was memorizing things. Did I tell you about my first Hebrew prof that I had? Did I tell you about him, the story about him going to Israel? And we got his master's degree in theology. Then he went to Harvard and got a PhD in Semitic studies or Hebrew languages. Then he spent 2 years in Israel living with a rabbi and his family. And now this is many years later from anything we're talking about here. This is more of a modern era and everything. But he goes and he lives with him for 2 years. And their routine every morning, 6 days a week, not on the Sabbath, Shabbat, but 6 days a week in the morning, from breakfast almost until lunch, they would go for a walk together. Have I told you this?
I remember it now.
Okay. And the Hebrew, the rabbi would start quoting from someplace in the Old Testament and maybe do that for an hour sequentially through the text. And then he would stop and it would be my prof's turn to pick up wherever he stopped and to keep on going. And they would do that for like three and a half hours every morning. Now that was in more modern day. That's indicative of the kind of memory they had in their day. Everything was memorized, and it was word for word and very detailed. So to answer your question a little bit, that's how some of that worked and everything. They didn't have the text of the book of Genesis, but what Moses is writing down, inspired by God, is what he had heard the transition all the way along in terms of the stories. another thing, number eight there in your notes, warfare or military tactics. Do you have that on there? Okay. And Genesis 14, where the four kings from the east come and they take Sodom and Gomorrah and take a lot of people away captive. They're going back up the Israel, modern day Israel, toward Lebanon. They're almost to Lebanon. When Abraham and his farmhands catch up with these four kings and their armies and defeats them and brings Lot and his family back home along with others as well. How does he do that? Well, we could say, like I mentioned last time, God was with him and helped him, and that is true. But he also had studied military tactics and was very good at that. He had served in the military because that was mandatory, but he had studied that. Now then, any questions about any of those things? We went over that last time, but I just want to reiterate and go a little bit deeper.
We know that Israel requires that young men and women both serve in the military for a certain number of years, 2 or 3 years, but Abraham was kind of the start of Israel, right? I mean, what did that look like for him when you say he was in the military?
Yeah.
What military was he in?
Good.
It wasn't Israel.
He was in Sumer, in Ur, he was in the military, where he came from in southern Iraq. This area that we're studying of ancient Mesopotamia, where he is from, it was mandatory for all boys, when they finished school around 13 or 14 years of age, military was mandatory. I think it was 2 years, 3 years, something like that. Mandatory military service. I think so.
I think so.
When you stop and think about modern day Israel, there are approximately 6.5 million Jewish people living in Israel, surrounded by over 50 million people who are of the Islamic faith. Most of those countries, I'm not saying most, not all Muslims, but most of those countries either would just as soon Israel go away, or they have a death wish for Israel. So if you're 6.5 million people surrounded by 50 million people who want to get rid of you, you have to learn how to defend yourself and protect yourself. And that's what Israel has done. Now, Israel today is a little different in that it is mandatory. Military service is mandatory for all boys, but also all girls. It's a shorter period of time for the women than it is the men, but it's mandatory for all. But in Abraham's day, all boys, 13, 14, when they finish school, they go into the military.
Just to put it in context, I mean, some of us in here have served in the military. Like, you don't serve before you're 18. Parents can, you know, sign a waiver or something, but you're telling me, like, their army was primarily made up of 15 to 18 year old boys?
A lot of it would have been, yes, but not exclusively. It doesn't mean that everybody got out at the end of that time. There were people who became professional military and everything, but every boy had to serve. Yeah. And you stop and think about it, by the time you're 16, 18 years old, when you're done with the military, you're at a point where, in their culture, where you're getting married. They got married much earlier than we tend to today. Starting a family, you got to be able to support the family and all that. Couldn't do that in the military. So if they waited longer, it would have really messed up their cultural norms and everything. To have waited till you were 20 or 23 would have been considered way out of whack for them. Even Mary, when she got married, she was a young teenager, from all that we can tell. That was pretty common in their culture.
I was going to say, not a question about the military, but I was just going to say, is
mostly why Israel has those walls today, from the defend from the terrorist attacks, because all the little side groups that want to attack them. Because I know they recently, not recently, it's probably a couple of years ago when I read about it, when they were discussing how to break down those walls, pretty much how Iran and all those places were discussing kind of a peace treaty between them, possibly some sort. I guess it didn't go well because those walls are obviously still standing.
Yeah.
So that's why, are they facing a lot of terrorist attacks still?
That's a good question. Israel is, modern day Israel, they have built walls around the Palestinian cities. Israel did that. People can come and go as they want to from those cities, but they have to go through screening. And the reason that Israel ended up building those walls around Palestinian cities was because of the suicide bombers who were coming out of those cities, out of a Palestinian city, driving down 3, 4, 5, 10 miles to a Jewish city, and walking into a restaurant or a store and blowing themselves up and killing a lot of people, or getting on a bus and blowing it up and killing a lot of people. But they could come, and they found virtually all of them were coming from these Palestinian cities. So now then what they've done is build a wall, so if you come out of that city, you get checked by the Israeli military before you have to go through a screening to leave. You can leave, you can come and go as much as you want, you just have to go through a checkpoint right outside the gate of the city. What it has done is eliminated about 90% of the suicide bombings that were taking place. Okay? So that's why we often hear about how horrible Israel is for walling in the Palestinians. But there again, people can come and go all they want. There's nothing to keep them from leaving. There's a lot going on over there that our news media often distorts. When you get to know it for what it really is and see it over there. I have not met an Israeli person over there yet who the heartbeat that they have isn't for peace. That's all they want, is peace. That's all they want. They're not looking to win anything or gain anything. All they want is peace. And again, 6.5 million people surrounded by 50 million, and on all sides, except for the Mediterranean. The water isn't against them, but everything else is. So all they want is peace. Now, they also believe that one of the ways to get that, if they sort of have a philosophy, peace will often come through strength, show of force. So if they get hit, they hit right back, and that sort of thing. And
kind of like everybody's thing.
Well,
we drop an atomic Hiroshima bomb on you.
Yeah, well, I don't want to get into the politics of all that, but anyway, I just it is something that has worked well for Israel over the years. Again, you've it's a matter of survival.
Yeah.
And okay. Back to your notes. letter B about religion. We talked about polytheism. We talked about how Terah, Abraham's father, there in Joshua 24 is referred to as a polytheist. He believed in other gods, many other gods, and that sort of thing. On page 7, we talked about the religious temples or the ziggurat. When you studied, when you read through and came to the Tower of Babel, I don't know what you imagined in your mind the Tower of Babel would have looked like, but it probably was much more like this. What they had to build with in the plains of Shinar or Sumer, okay, that's the same place. When you talked about the plains of Shinar where the Tower of Babel was built, you're talking about Sumer. And predating Abraham. But it was probably something resembling, if not, a ziggurat is what they were building. Because all they had to build with was clay. That's all they had to build with. So this is the kind of structure, most likely, that the Tower of Babel was being built like. We tend to think of a small, skinny tower going straight up, like the Tower of Pisa or something, going up like that. The problem is you can't do that with clay brick very far. You just can't do it. Not with the brick-making skills they had or didn't have yet, like we have today. Their idea of baking clay bricks was putting it out in the sun. So it just didn't ever get as hard as if you fire it, like we know you need to do today and can do to make it harder. But even then, you can't build something out of brick, even fired bricks, very high, without it eventually beginning to crumble because of the weight. So this is probably the kind of structure that the Tower of Babel was, something along these lines and everything. So we talked about, let's skip down to the cultural infrastructure. We never got to this, and I want to make sure we have some time on this. The religious states I talk about here, I call them religious states because they didn't separate. We talk about a separation of church and state kind of a thing, or religion and politics. They didn't do that. That everything was combined. The king in most of these city-states that were there in Sumer was both the high priest, so to speak. He was the highest religious leader, and he was the political leader. And often he was the military leader as well. So he would be over all of those things, but he would have been both a political and religious leader, and usually a military leader as well. City-states there, I mentioned a number of all of those cities on that front map of that handout. If you look at that, all of those cities surrounding Ur were cities. Each one of them was its own city-state, had its own king and everything. But under the Ur III dynasty, even though they had their own king and their own laws and everything, they all came under the Ur III dynasty, and the king of Ur was the king of those kings. When you hear the little phrase, king of all kings and lord of all lords, it goes back to this time when there would be a king who was over other kings and would supersede them, and the law of Ur was like, it would be very similar to the United States today. We have 50 states that have their own political systems, their own governors, their own congresses, and that sort of thing. But we have a federal government that same time supersedes. If there's a conflict between the city, between the state government or laws and the federal government laws will supersede and trump every time, okay? The state laws. So that's what was going on here in the Ur III dynasty. Warfare, I talked about the Elamites to the east in modern-day Iran, and the Akkadians to the north, who eventually become the core of the Assyrians in the future. Both of them were very warlike groups that were descendants of Shem also, along with Sumer. But they would attack Sumer. That's why there had to be military training and presence. The Sumerians were not a warlike people by nature. They defended themselves. And they had to learn how to do that, and they were able to do that quite well. Populations, I talked about that. The whole kingdom of Ur III was around, and its influence, probably influenced about 1 million people. In Sumer, there were about 500,000 people. In the city of Ur and around it were 250,000 people. That's how the size of this kingdom in that day was going on. Now then, on the next page, there are a few things here that are going to be of real interest, I think, hopefully. City life. If we went to Ur during the days of Abraham, you would have found a city surrounded by a wall that was 2.5 miles long. That was pretty big. The circumference of the city wall, if you went all the way around Ur, 2.5 miles altogether. That's a lot of wall. The walls were 77 inches thick. We still have the base of many of them. 77 inches thick at the base, and it would taper up, again, because they're building out of brick, and they needed to do that. It created a more solid structure, a more durable structure to do it that way. About 25,000 people out of the 250,000 people that lived in Ur, about 10% of them, 25,000 people, lived within those walls, within that 2.5 mile circumference circle. Inside that wall would be the ziggurat. It would be the seat of government. It would be the library would be there. It would be the primary area for education, not exclusively, but a lot of the education took place within that. The religious activities would be focused inside the walls. The walls were not only tall and thick to defend against enemies, but also from the spring rains that would come. And you would have to go up and over into going through the walls. So the gates of the wall weren't just ground level at the bottom. You would have to go up and over. And again, they were always built, the thresholds, we would call them, were always built on the walls and on the houses to exceed or go above what the flood levels would be in the spring rain, when the spring rains came. So that it kept water out, it also kept enemies out, this wall that was there. Housing inside of the, it's just fun to talk about because we have so much specific information. The houses inside, you would have a street that would be 4.5 feet wide. Why 4.5 feet? Because an ox cart was between 3.5 and 4 feet. And so a street would allow people, but it'd also be wide enough for an ox cart to go down, carrying goods.
All this is inside the building?
All this is inside. This is inside the city. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. 4.5 feet wide.
So you're just looking at a street, and on the street, each street there would be houses. Okay? So, and it'd be actually be a lot bigger than that, but if this is 4.5 feet, these are all about 2,000 to 2,500 square feet homes.
Oh. 20 feet by 20 feet.
Yeah, and, well, they're also two stories. Okay? So they're two stories high. They're anywhere from 2,000 to 2,500 square feet. They're single family homes. It was very rare from the histories that we have and the accounts that we have of extended families living all together. Now, later on, when we get to Israel, we're going to see some of the same kind of thing. You'll see that in the houses they have and everything as well. But they would add on to the house and create wings of the house for the son and his new bride and their family. And as they had children, they would add on to their wing and all of that. But there's some reasons for that.
You look at just about any city, they're not going to create cramped roads like that, purely just wide enough to get, you know, like a donkey cart through.
Right.
Is that also to prevent against enemies? For instance,
if
like
it
a
was,
chair,
we don't
chariot know. Wouldn't be able to get through that, but
yeah,
a horse-driven cart could.
Yeah. And I don't know if a chariot could get, a chariot could get through. If it was 4.5 feet wide, yeah, that it could get through. At least many of them.
Gotcha.
I think more than anything else is how many people can we get inside the wall? I think that's what they're trying to do. Cram as many people as they can inside the wall. Because again, when they're attacked, you know, the people outside the wall don't have the protection that the people inside the wall do. So there, how many people can we get in?
They would be shared walls, or they would be
yes.
standing structures?
No, they would be shared walls like this. So let's take one of these and blow it up. And here's what it would look like. There would, off of the street, there would be a gate. And again, with a threshold, you'd have to go up and over into the house. You get inside the house, and it would be something like this. This would be a courtyard. They could grow plants, food, that kind of thing in the courtyard. That's where they would play. That would be their yard inside the house. This is all 2 stories high. All of their living space was on the first floor, although the bedrooms and that sort of thing were upstairs. So all the living space. A lot of this would be open off of the courtyard without no windows. I mean, they didn't have glass windows and all that. It would just all be open. This would all be solid, no windows, okay? No windows. This is a shared wall with the next thing. This is a shared wall with the next thing and everything. So there are no windows any place in the thing, but all of this is open. This courtyard and everything is all open to the elements. If you go to some parts of Central and South America and some places in Europe today, you will see these kind of homes today. As well. I was down in Antigua, Guatemala, not too long ago, or a few years ago, not too many years ago, and was invited to come to a home for dinner. I mean, I felt like I was back in ancient Mesopotamia. It's exactly what it was like. There were no windows. This is modern day. No windows in any of this first floor structure. It all opened out onto the courtyard. And everything.
So what about when it rains? Like, they don't get floods in the house? Or?
Again, they would get at most around 6 inches of rain a year.
Oh.
It's sort of like asking, what about when it rains in Fresno?
what happens, you know?
The streets
we
get
just
wet.
Yeah. Now then, I do need to say because of the rains that did come when they came, and because they were downriver from in Iraq, they were at the base of where the Euphrates River goes into the Persian Gulf at that time, they would get floods. They wouldn't get as much rain necessarily, that would be the problem, but it was the rain all the way up into Turkey. And all that water comes all the way down. The mountains of Turkey would be there as well, that would feed that river, the rains. So there would be a flood season every year. Even though they didn't get a lot of rain right there, the rains all along the Euphrates River would cause it to flood where they were at. Okay? So that's what their houses were like and that sort of thing. They had a lot of children as well. Let's talk about marriage and family for a second. This is very interesting to me. One of the laws that we found in the tablets that we have unearthed showed some of the laws going back to the Ur III dynasty when Abraham was born and raised there. And one of those laws said this. This is all the law said. Be fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth. Sound familiar? I hope that sounds familiar from Genesis chapter 1. Okay? That's exactly what God in Genesis chapter 1 tells Abraham, tells Adam and Eve, be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth. And he goes on and he says, subdue it and rule over it. But that was one of their laws. And then they had sub-laws or things under that as well. And one of those things was how important it was for every couple to have male children, because they wanted to produce the seed that could produce more children. So every family was required to have male children. Well, what if you can't have children? What if a woman is not capable, or her husband and wife are not capable of having children? Then the wife is responsible for providing an alternative for her husband so that they as a family will produce children. What if she has children but they're all girls? Then the wife is responsible for providing an alternative for her husband, a concubine, okay, who would be able to produce male children. That was part of their law. Think about, you're getting ready, I don't think you've got there quite yet, but you're getting ready to talk about Abraham and Sarah and the fact that she is barren. And she comes up with this harebrained idea of giving her concubine to Abraham. And Abraham is crazy enough to say, okay, why? Is it because that's the right thing to do? No, but that is what they were used to. That is something they grew up with. That was not only acceptable, for the culture they grew up in, it was mandatory that they do that. Now, does that make it right? No, not necessarily, but at all. But you get the idea of where they came up, where Sarah comes up with this idea, and why Abraham is willing to go along with it, because that was so important in their culture that they do that. Okay?
That's crazy.
And they had a lot of children. Be fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth. And that's what they were trying to do. They had lots of children. That's why these were single family homes. Because they would have 10, 12, 14 children. Would not be uncommon at all. That would be very, very common to have that many children. Well, you need a lot of space
for that many children and everything. So
how did they provide the infrastructure like economically wise? I mean, kids are expensive. All the clothes, all the food.
Yeah. So how did they provide for them? Their whole they were an agrarian society living in a desert, but they were agrarian and they exported food, and they got a lot of income from that. They exported wool. They were great at raising sheep, and they exported wool. Their mineralogy, I told you that Abraham studied that. They exported that. There in Sumer, I forget what they're called now. They're basically tar pits, oil sands that exist there. They would export that as well. The oil sand, remember when you studied Noah building the ark, and he coated the outside of the ark? It was from the oil sands that were there. It's sand. It's oil in a sandy thing that's real soft, and you can dig it up and use it. It becomes very pliable. And the largest field of that in the world is right there in Sumer. Okay? And they would export that for the building of ships and boats and that sort of thing, for waterproofing any other kind of structure that they needed to around the world, where they would export things. So they would do that.
So then each family like had their own portion of that, or just the city as a general was just an export city, and then they used the funds as like a welfare system? Or like how does each one family?
Families took, good question. Families took care of themselves. They took care of each other. So it wasn't so much, never did the state take care of people in that culture at all. But families would take care of each other. And there would be people within the family who were more productive than others, who were more capable at certain things than others. But the family would all take care of each other and look out for each other. So rather than there being a sharing of the wealth at a national level, there was a sharing of the wealth at a family level.
Okay.
They took care of each other. So Abraham's father was a wealthy man, and but he took care of his family and made it possible for everyone else. Abraham was a wealthy man because it started with his father, and he inherits his father's wealth. And everything. But before his father ever dies, he had already established himself as well and built his own herds and that sort of thing. That he would, so he would sell the wool, he would sell the mutton, he would sell the beef from the cattle and that sort of thing. He would sell camels to people who were travelers. And everything, he could make a living doing a lot of those kind of things. Even when he's in Israel, he's raising herds. A lot of the arguments and skirmishes he has, contentions he has, is over the herds that he has and that sort of thing. Try raising sheep in a rock-covered desert. What do they eat? How do you take care of them? There's very little water. What we would call grass is virtually non-existent. And he would graze huge herds of sheep there in the desert and everything. He learned how to do that somewhere, and that was in Ur. Most of the trade with that Ur had was along the Fertile Crescent, it's called. so they would go up and around and over. That was where most of their trade took place. Okay, I'm going to stop there. The rest of the notes that you have are pretty self-explanatory. They're just lists of some things that are there. But I want to get into Genesis chapter 1. Okay. Yes.
Is this the Genesis 1:1, Genesis 1:2 stuff?
Yes. Yes. Okay. You will need to open your Bibles to Genesis 1:1. So, verse 1 is an absolute statement of fact. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Mike has gone over that, and he did a phenomenal job walking you through the four key things there. There was a beginning. God was responsible for it, and everything he created. And he talked about what that meant, and the heavens and the earth, or the heavens and the earth. In the Old Testament, I think Mike probably got into this, is another way of saying the universe. Okay? That's what we would call it today. Then you come to verse 2. The earth was formless and void, and darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was moving or hovering or guarding over the surface of the waters. You have different translations in front of you, different ones of you. Anybody begin verse 2 differently than just the earth was formless and void? Anybody have a...
It says, oh wait, no, but it just says empty.
But what? How? What's the first word of verse 2?
Oh, now.
Now, okay.
Yeah.
Any others?
I'm checking the different variants.
Some of them will say, and... The earth was formless and void. Some will say, then the earth was formless and void. Some will say, and then the earth was formless and void. The real question comes down to the conjunction that begins verse 2 in Hebrew. The conjunction that begins verse 2 is a simple little letter that is added at the beginning of a word, which is our word for and. And means what it means determined by the context. Let me give you an example that I use all the time. If I told you I went to the grocery store and I bought milk and bread and cheese and eggs, I've just used the word and a number of times there, and what you think of is a collection of things that went in a grocery sack and I took them home. Right? I bought milk and egg and cheese and eggs. Yeah, whatever I just said. Yeah. Yeah, anyway. but I bought these four things, put them in a grocery sack, I took them home. The context tells me that I use the word and as a collection of things. Now, we use the word and in English other ways as well. So if I backed up in that story and I said, I got up this morning and I realized I didn't have what I wanted for breakfast in the refrigerator. So I went to the bank and I took out some money. And I went to the grocery store and I bought milk and bread and eggs and cheese and whatever. Okay? And I went home and I fixed breakfast. all of a sudden I've used the word and in two different ways. Not only a collection of things at the grocery store that go in a sack, but now then I've introduced the idea of sequence. I did this, and I did this, and I did this. How do I know it's sequence? The context, the picture that I just painted for you. I got up and I realized there wasn't enough food, there wasn't what I wanted in the refrigerator for breakfast. So I go to the grocery store, I went to the bank, and I took out money. And I went to the grocery store, and I went home, and I fixed breakfast. That's a sequence of events that I've connected with the word and. So I've used it as a collection of things, to collect things together. I've used it as a sequence, to string things together in a sequence. Does that make sense? Context for us determines how we translate the word and. It was the same thing, is the same thing in Hebrew. How do we translate this little letter here, this conjunction at the beginning of verse 2? It's determined by the context. So we have to look at it. It's used in one of two primary ways in Hebrew. One would be descriptive way, and the other would be a sequence, like with us. Those are the two primary ways that this little word and in Hebrew, this conjunction, is used. It's either descriptive of something or it is sequential. So which is it here? Is verse 2 describing? Is it descriptive of verse 1? Of the earth in verse 1? And the earth was formless and void? Is that the way the earth was in verse 1 when it was created? It's describing that. Or is it sequential? Is it something that follows verse 1? Okay, now let's look at the context more carefully. The earth was formless and void. It's only used, that phrase is only used two other places in the Old Testament, formless and void. It's used Jeremiah chapter 4, Isaiah 34. Uses those, that same phrase, formless and void. And in both of those situations, it's a forecasting, it's looking into the future prophetically and seeing Jerusalem in one case and the nations in another case that have been judged by God, totally destroyed and left formless and void. Jeremiah 4, 19 to 26 talks about a vision of Judah being destroyed in the future and left. God's judgment comes, it's destroyed, and it's left formless and void. Isaiah 34, 1 to 2, and then in verse all the way through verse 11 talks about the future destruction of the, prophetically, of the nations that will be judged by God, destroyed and left formless and void. Okay? Now those are the only two places where formless and void as a phrase are used together. When you read those passages, you need to realize I'm talking about the Hebrew text. Your English translation may use a little bit different words than formless and void in those verses sometimes. But that's their exact same Hebrew words and the exact same Hebrew phrase that's used here, formless and void.
So it never says God shaped the earth. Does this mean the earth is flat? I'm just playing. I know it's not flat. It's just like there's this huge debate about it now.
Okay.
It's so funny.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm so serious. You should see it on
Facebook. It is, yes. I've seen that a lot. Oh my goodness, yes.
I've never heard this.
Oh, the flat earth.
It's a lot of Christians too.
Because it's formless and he never said he shaped it, so.
Even though there is another passage in Scripture that refers to the earth as a sphere.
Yeah.
They sort of ignore that one, but anyway.
Of course.
So the earth was formless, and this in verse 2, the earth was formless and void. Whatever happens here in verse 2, the earth is formless and void. Every other place that's used, the other two places it's used, it means it's a picture of God bringing judgment on something, destroying it, and leaving it formless and void. Okay? Now that's, you can't build a case on that, but we just need to realize as we're going through this, that's how that phrase is used as well. Some people will get into tearing down the words formless and void and show how in the text there are other places where formless means a little something different and void means a little something different and everything. But we need to understand this as a phrase. Formless and void. If this was the only place formless and void was used as a phrase, that would be different. Then you could do that. But because it's used other places as a phrase also, we have to look at it as a phrase. It would be like me saying, my grandson is far and away the best soccer player on his team. Okay? I just used the little phrase, far and away. What does the word far mean?
Distant.
Distant, okay. What does away mean?
Separated.
Okay, away, not close, away, separated, and that sort of thing. Is that what I was saying?
No.
Because the phrase, far and away, has its own meaning, doesn't it? And we understand that. And if I try to explain what far and away means in that phrase by breaking it down and telling you what the word far means and what the word away means, I'm missing the whole point. Right? That's what we have to be careful about here, I believe, personally, is trying to deconstruct something that is used as a phrase, not only here but other places, to mean something. So, anyway. And by the way, my grandson is not the far and away the best. just an illustration. Darkness was over the surface of the deep. When it talks about darkness was over the surface of the deep, what is the deep? What's the picture here in verse 2?
So space is empty.
It's the earth. All the way through the Old Testament, the deep refers to the ocean. Okay? So what is the earth covered by?
Water.
Water. Do we ever see that again in Genesis where the earth is covered by water?
Yes.
What brought that about?
Judgment.
God brought judgment on the earth in the form of a flood. What do we see here? The earth is covered with water. Can you build a case on that? No, but I'm trying to put together context for all of this and everything. The Spirit of God was moving over the surface of the waters. That word moving or hovering, it's a picture of guarding. The picture in the Hebrew here of that particular word is the idea of a guardian over something. So here's what I know from verse 2, from the way it's there. Verse 2 has some kind of a relationship to verse 1. I'm trying to determine if it is a description of the earth. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was formless. Is it describing the earth that is created in verse 1? Or is it something that is describing the earth after, sequentially, at some other point in time? And I believe, personally, there is textually more evidence to support the sequential aspect of things than there is descriptive. There's one other reason why. Someone turn to Isaiah 45. And read verse 18. In
Isaiah 45:18, Isaiah is recounting the creation story a little bit.
18?
Yeah.
For thus says the Lord who created the heavens, he is God, who formed the earth and made it, who established it, he did not create it empty, he formed it, he inhabited it. I am the Lord, there is no other.
He did not create it what?
It empty.
And that's the exact same word in Hebrew for formless. He did not create it formless. Now that creates a problem for me. Because if he didn't create it formless, and I'm saying that it's descriptive of the earth in verse 1, that the earth that he created, then I'm saying God created the earth formless and void. And Isaiah 45 says he didn't create it formless. So not only does the context tell me something in turn, give me a picture anyway, of an earth that it seems as if has been judged by God in some form or fashion. He's brought judgment upon it and everything. But I also get from Isaiah 45, he did not create it formless. He didn't create it that way. That means it had to become that way. Okay, so that's why I look at this letter in the Hebrew alphabet, the way, or this word that is used at the beginning of verse 2. Most likely, to me, textually, it seems like whatever is happening in verse 2 is something that happened after verse 1. That the earth that was created in verse 1 has faced God's judgment for some reason, and has been left formless and void. It has experienced a flood. By the way, whether you believe in all this or not, the world has experienced two floods. Verse 2 is a picture of the world underwater. Chapter 6, when we get to the flood story there, it's underwater. Okay? That's twice, not just once, that we see that in the Bible. So it just seems like textually that, to me, it makes more sense that that's happened. Now then, there is a theory out there called the gap theory, and I am not a gap theorist, okay? I did not come across what I believe here, what I'm teaching you, from studying this thing called the gap theory. The gap theory was something that was popularized during the earlier days of the promotion of evolution, and they were, a lot of people jumped on the bandwagon, not with the textual study, but with the idea of this could mean, this is something that took place afterwards, there could be billions of years in between verses 1 and 2, and that would leave room for evolution. First of all, neither biblically nor scientifically do I believe in evolution. Okay? So I'm not trying to make room for anything in all there. I'm not trying to say how long it was. It could have been a matter of moments between verses 1 and 2. That, and if the earth was judged for whatever reason. When we look at Isaiah 14 and Ezekiel 28, Satan rebels against God, and God casts him and a third of all the angels where?
The earth.
To the earth, okay? To this earth of verse 1, we know at least. Could it be after verse 1 is when that took place? And whatever Satan did on the earth, and whatever happened here, it brought God's judgment on the earth. And God reformed. So our 6 days of creation, if this is true, would really be 6 days of reformation that we would be looking at. And if it makes you look a little bit at Genesis chapter 1 differently. So God creates man and woman, male and female. He created them in the image. image of God, he created them. He tells them, I want you to do five things. We looked at three of them earlier. I want you to be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, subdue it, and rule over it. The word subdue is only used 15 times in the Hebrew, that particular word. Every other time, it clearly means to forcibly bring under control that which is out of control. So tell me, when you get to verse 28 of Genesis chapter 1, what is out of control that needs to be forcibly brought under control? The only thing that we can see in the first three chapters of Genesis would be Satan and his forces, his demons. His angelic beings, fallen angels, have come with him. That's the only thing that could possibly be. They're introduced in chapter 3, but at the end of every day, what we've seen so far is God says, it's good, it's good, it's good, it's good. In fact, he gets to the sixth day, it's very good. Everything's just the way it ought to be, and everything in the formation that God is making. But why does he tell Adam and Eve to forcibly bring under control something that's out of control? And again, I think it very well may be Satan and his forces. And part of the purpose of mankind being here was to retake planet Earth. And when you get to Romans chapter 5, you see, you're going to get there with Shay. When you get to Romans chapter 5, the second half of that chapter, he's going to talk about the first Adam and the second Adam, who was Christ. And what the first Adam failed to do, the second Adam did. And what did he do that the first Adam failed to do?
Temptation.
Okay? He subdued. He brought under control that which was out of control through his death and then his resurrection. He gave a death knell to Satan and his forces when he rose from the dead. Satan is a dead angel. He's a dead angel walking, so to speak. Dead man walking. His days are numbered. From the time Jesus rose from the dead, it's over. And he is a desperate angelic being, trying to get as much power and influence, trying to do anything he can to upset what is inevitable because of what Jesus Christ did and everything. So what we failed to do, the second Adam, Jesus, actually did do. But he was a God-man that was able to accomplish that. Okay. Questions? Comments, objections. Yeah.
So was it the? It was the blow of God, or the blow of them being sent to the earth, or?
We don't know. If my speculations are true, we don't know why. We don't know what. I don't know. I don't know of anything biblically or otherwise that would give us a clue of what happened in between verses 1 and 2, if indeed if there is a between verses 1 and 2.
I know C.S. Lewis believes the same thing, that it has something to do with the judgment that God had with the angels who rebelled.
Yeah, and it very well could be. And it very well could be that they, there was something that took place that they were doing on the earth. We don't know if there were there dinosaurs on the earth at that point? Were there other, whatever, I don't know. We don't know what was going on, but whatever it was, if my speculations are correct, it was something that brought God's judgment. But Satan and the angels had already been judged to send them to the earth. This was where he sent them, and this became their domain. This became Satan's kingdom. He is still referred to in the New Testament as the prince of the power of the air. this is his, so to speak, in his mind anyway. It's where he was put. And God is retaking that from him. Yeah.
So if Satan and the demon were sent to the earth and then the earth was covered in water, was that too, I
think the being covered in water, again, the only other place we see that is in Genesis 6, the Genesis flood that you've studied. And that was a result of God's judgment. It's the way he judged. All I'm saying is, if that's the only other place we see it, it seems like it's not too far of a stretch to say it could have been a judgment in verse 2 as well. Whatever Satan, for whatever reason, we don't know. I don't think the text speaks to that. I don't think the text speaks to how long of a period between verses 1 and 2, if I'm right, as well. It could, again, be a matter of moments, or it could have been a matter of millennia. It just doesn't say, and I don't want to make it say something either. I got right back here.
Uh-huh. I had some non-wild questions.
Okay.
You said that there's two floods in the Bible. Do we have evidence here on earth that shows that it's been covered twice?
Well, yes, but has science even looked for that? No. Yeah, they don't believe there was one flood, so.
The Ararat boat doesn't make it.
Science doesn't acknowledge that. Even though there are flood stories, I mentioned that before, over 200 flood stories all the way from South America to Russia. Yeah, science still won't acknowledge that. That possibility, let alone reality. So, it's very hard to understand why on some of the tallest mountains we've been able to do certain amounts of excavation and everything, there are seashells and sea creatures found in the rubble on top of some of the highest mountains. How in the world did those things get there? Any other questions at all? You guys are easy.
I don't know if it's so much as a question, but when we were hanging out earlier, you mentioned some aspects about like Darwin and his, what you had read from him and some of his statements. I don't know if that's what we're bringing up. But.
The question about Darwin, I said I don't believe in evolution both from a biblical or a scientific point of view. I've read approximately 1,700 pages of Darwin from beginning to end. In his last, the introduction to his, in the last chapter of his last book that he wrote, he writes to future scientists who will be pursuing the theory of evolution. As he called it, it was a theory. And he said clearly, it is not a fact. It is still a theory. And it will never be a fact until a couple of things have been pursued further. And he's giving a charge to future scientists to pursue those things, those two things. the two things he says that one would, either one of which, either take place or didn't take place, if we can find evidence for it, would support or undermine the theory of evolution. By the way, he also gives a warning that says it is a theory, and he warns future scientists, don't make it a fact until these two things have been taken care of. Because as soon as you make evolution a fact, scientists stop becoming scientists and start becoming propagandists. That was Darwin warning future scientists not to make it a fact until these two things. What were the two things? One was Darwin had shown through his study and research that there is evolution within species. Okay? God created all the animals it talks about and all the different things after their kind.
within species. There in Genesis chapter 1. That's what it means when he says he created them after their own kind. He created them according to species. What Darwin could never show, never had any evidence that one species evolved into another species. Okay? Anytime we even try it, we end up with sterility, which means it can't be passed on. Okay? And it just doesn't work. So he says, we've got to somehow find that, what he called the missing link, showing somewhere where one species evolves into another. At some point, I mean, he doesn't believe human beings stepped out of the primordial ooze. He believed there was a single cell creature that oozed out of the primordial ooze and evolved into something else, into something greater, into some kind of a fish, into some kind of a reptile, into some kind of a, you know, and eventually we come out of that. Okay? Over millions and millions of years. By the way, Darwin was the one who postulated for evolution to be possible. We can't look at time traditionally. There have to have been millions or billions of years for this to evolve, because all of his research showed how slow the development of evolution was. So there's got to be the discovery of this missing link. Secondly, the second thing he said is, he did not have the scientific tools to be able to research at the microscopic level. So cells at the microscopic level, he couldn't do that. He didn't have electron and atomic microscopes and those kind of things available to him that we have today. but he said this, if when we are able to study at the microscopic level, at the micro, at the cellular level, if we find complexity at the microscopic level within cells, it totally disproves evolution. Because the whole theory of evolution is built upon the assumption that there is simplicity that develops into complexity. And he says, but if we find complexity at the cellular level, that means it came that way. It didn't evolve into that at the basic cellular level. What have we found today? Tremendous complexity. So complex, we're still trying to figure out how it works. We can't do it. It is so complex. Why? We look at cells today and we can see that they have motors and rudders and those kinds of things that move them. We see the nucleus of those cells, and we cannot figure out what happens when you disrupt the nucleus of a cell. What happens? It's called a nuclear explosion, which is unbelievably catastrophic. What holds those nucleuses of the cells together, those little power engines within a cell? We still can't figure that out, what holds them all together and keeps them from just exploding and into a nuclear bomb.
Poetry,
I don't think we have to mess with or play with Genesis to, I think we can take it at face value and don't have to play around with it to still be consistent with these things.
Well, so. I tend to hold to it as more poetic.
Why?
Well, because of a number of reasons. One, like you look at the refrains of it, and then the logical order of creation. But the logical order of creation is actually fixed in Genesis 2. So, for instance, vegetation prior to atmospheric, the ability even to produce vegetation in Genesis 1 versus in Genesis 2, the order of things are structured accordingly.
Or you can look at Hebrew literature and look at holistic writing, it's called.
Okay.
And holistic writing, when you look at Genesis 1 and 2, it's very consistent with other Hebrew literature of that same kind called holistic writing, where they give the big picture that is not specific to begin with, and then they draw out from that the most important thing and highlight it. It's very much like a, if I had a map of the state of California on here, it'd be like this. If I had a big map of the state of California, it's very general. Over here, I would have some relief maps. I'd have San Francisco, I'd have LA, I'd have Fresno for sure over here as a relief map and everything. But why? If this is the state of California, and there's a relief map over here of LA. LA is big, but is it half the size of the state? People in LA might think so, but no, it's not. Why do we expand it? Because it's an important thing and we want to zero in, and you'll get more detail in the relief map, more specific details. That's what holistic writing is like.
Sure.
In the Hebrew literature.
I've heard some of those arguments, but like the refrain.
It's not an argument, it's just literature.
Well, no, the argument for that point, but I'm saying like the refrains in Genesis, one makes it seem much more poetic. I'm just from reading different commentators, like Victor Hamilton and other guys on that.
Yeah.
This,
even if it's written in poetic form, doesn't mean it's not true and not accurate. Yeah. Yeah. Let me pray and get you out of here, okay? Father, thank you so much for who you are. And you've given us so much. We just thank you for that. Thanks for your word, and thanks for giving us the ability to understand history and culture and understand literature the way you have. I just appreciate that so much. And I pray you would use your word in our lives. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.
Uh-huh.
Oh my God. Did I tell you about that? This guy is like the biggest joker. So we got out of this group, like, and I was like, I was like,